Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
We welcome you here. Join us here at 410-319-8888. We can make your pledge of support to WEAA. Before we jump into this conversation, remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's not just a bank, it's a credit union. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. For more information, www.mecu.com. Go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. And we want to introduce you in the first part of our program. We'll be talking with Ron James, Jr. Ron James is an attorney in D.C. Wrote the books Root and Branch, Charles Hamilton Houston, Thurgood Marshall and the Struggle to End Segregation. His latest book is The Double V, How Wars, Protest, and Harry Truman Desegregated America's Military. And Double V, of course, stands for the World War II symbol, victory of fascism and racism abroad and at home. It wasn't that easy over the years, and he's written a book to tell that history. And Ron James, Jr., welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Mark. Happy to be here.
Great to have you with us. This is an amazing book. I almost want to start in the middle, but I won't. Because the World War I and World War II, especially World War I and post-World War II, really were just amazing stories. But this struggle of segregation and limiting the role of black folks in the military, it was at the heart of the founding of this country and the Revolutionary War. This is something that didn't just happen.
That's absolutely right, Mark. The Continental Congress, one of the first things that it did was expunge African-Americans from the Continental Army. And they said they did not want any black soldiers. And General George Washington was a very strong proponent of it. And this is in no small part because he was a plantation owner in Virginia. And at that time, about half the population of the state of the Commonwealth of what would become the Commonwealth of Virginia, half the population of the colony of Virginia were African-American slaves. So the Continental Congress eliminated African-Americans from the Continental Army until about a year later when they realized that they needed more soldiers. And suddenly the Continental Army began to accept African-Americans in fighting, and the African-American soldiers and the white soldiers fought in integrated units together.
Now, in past shows for other books that we've talked about the Revolutionary War and the role African-Americans played, we really hit that intensely, and your book covers it in the beginning, but you really, the heart of your book is about World War I, World War II, and its aftermath. And which I think is important because this is very little. I think this is part of our history that we really don't know in many ways. And let's jump into that if you don't mind, because I think that the whole World War One era. I mean, it was so definitive in many ways.
Yes.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Ron.
It truly was, Mark, and I think you're right. A lot we can. If you know a good high school student can tell you all about Christus Attucks.
Right.
But many of us who read history and some of us who work on history for a living are hard pressed to tell you much about World War One or what was then called the Great War, and it was a transformative war for the Western world certainly, but also was transformative for African Americans, and that's actually studying that experience. Is what led me to research and write the Double V, the entire book. In my first book, Root and Branch, in researching it, I learned about African Americans' collective experience in World War I and how that changed their collective mindset in the country. It changed it very rapidly. The African Americans' experience in World War I, it mobilized them together as nothing had since emancipation. And I was astonished by how that happened and why it happened.
As a matter of fact, one of the things is, before we have to go to break here, I want to set the tone for what happens in World War One, and where it begins. And you tell the story really well in at the end of one of your chapters of Charles Young. For those of us growing up, I grew up with Charles Young as one of my heroes, the great blacks in American history that you read, these little thin books that kids would get back in the 50s and early 60s. But tell the story, because to me that's emblematic of the crisis that developed, because so many African Americans wanted to fight in the war to say, we are equal, we can show you we'll fight for democracy despite racism and lynchings and discrimination. But tell the story of what happened with Charles Young and President Wilson.
Colonel Charles Young was an exceptional figure, having graduated from West Point, and he was the highest-ranking African-American officer in American history at the time. It was clear to everyone paying attention that America was trundling toward war, and the Great War in Europe had was receiving a great deal of attention here in the United States. It also became clear that Colonel Young, he was then a lieutenant colonel, was high enough in rank that there was no legitimate way the Army could prohibit him from commanding white soldiers. So what the Department of War, which now is the Department of Army, what the Department of War did under President Woodrow Wilson is they forcibly retired Lieutenant Colonel Young and explained to him that he had high blood pressure and a heart condition. To prove his fitness, Lieutenant Colonel Young picked out his best horse and rode that horse from Ohio to Washington, D.C., on a one-man cavalry that garnered a wide amount of press attention at the time and embarrassed the Woodrow Wilson administration. And the administration promoted him to colonel, but still made him retire. And Woodrow Wilson personally wrote a letter to the executive director of the NAACP explaining that Colonel Young's retirement had absolutely nothing to do with race and everything to do with the War Department's concern for his high blood pressure.
And we're going to take a break here and remind way out of here that we're talking about Charles Young, who was a man who was a veteran of the Civil War, who graduated from the U.S. Military Academy, first African-American to do so, was a veteran, was a Buffalo soldier, was a colonel in the Army, an amazing human being who was a friend of W.E.B. Du Bois's. All this is in this book. We're going to a very brief break and come back with Ron James Jr. about his book, The Double V. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're here with Ron James Jr. The book is The Double V, How Wars, Protest, and Harry Truman Desegregated the America's Military. And later on we'll talk about Harry Truman, raised by racist parents, and why he did what he did and how he did what he did. But first, we'll come back and Ron. One of the things that talk about World War One again, just stay here for a minute, because it's just so much complexity with this. To talk about people like Major General Charles Ballou and Des Moines, mm-hmm. and the training of black officers and that whole piece of that history.
Yes, the War Department, the Army had no African American officers. It was segregated at the time, and the Navy. The Navy had no African-American officers. The Navy did not allow African-Americans to do anything except cook and clean, serve in the mess, in the steward's mess. The Army allowed African-Americans to be soldiers, but only enlisted men and generally lower-ranking enlisted men. As it became clear that there was going to be a draft and that the draft was going to include all men, that everyone was going to be drafted, it began in Washington, D.C., a group of young men who were led initially by Joel Spinger, who founded the NAACP, a group of young men at Howard University, decided that if they were going to fight, they wanted to fight as officers. Because generally, if you were a white male in college at the time, you're drafted in as an officer. If you're African American, it didn't matter if you were in Harvard Medical School at the time; you were sent in as an enlisted man. And the men wanted to do something about this, and they organized an intense lobbying campaign. They walked through the halls of Congress. They gathered petitions. They said the cry was colored officers for colored soldiers. And they held dances at college campuses up and down the East Coast. And it was a grand success in that congressmen changed their minds. Yes, this was back in an age when congressmen and women sometimes did change their minds about things. And they said, we should have colored officers. So they established a separate camp. Of course, their initial petition was, please give us an integrated, allow us to train with white officers. This was going nowhere, of course, the Secretary of War. So they said, but Congress did say, we don't see any reason why these young men should not be able to be drafted as officers. And so the Colored Officers Training Camp was established in Fort Des Moines, Iowa. And the young men were so excited, and they said that in their own pamphlet that they passed out to the volunteers, they said, "Make no mistake, brother, the race is on trial." And that is the spirit with which they reported to Fort Des Moines in Iowa.
And part of the race being on trial, because these were some of the contradictions that happened during World War One and in this war, which is just fascinating history you've written here. People have written about this before, but the way you did it was, I thought, was really important because it leads into the other parts of the book about the Houston Mutiny at Camp Logan in Texas.
Yes, that was I truly consider the bookends of African Americans' experience in World War One. One is the Fort Des Moines, Iowa camp, which graduated 639 African Americans who became officers in the United States Army, and one of them was Charles Henry Houston. There were many distinguished men, doctors, attorneys, young Americans among those 639 soldiers. And on the other side, on what could really only aptly be described as the bitter end of the experience, there was what has come known as the Houston Mutiny. And this was, it's just like you say, Mark, there's so many different, it's so complicated, there's so many different aspects, factors that factored into what happened, but the bottom line of what happened is that many dozens of African American men were drafted as enlisted soldiers and sent to Houston, Texas, and where they were shocked by the virulence of the racism that they saw. They had never, even coming from New York and coming from Chicago and places like that, they knew racism. They weren't allowed to eat in restaurants. They could only live in certain neighborhoods, but they had never been told they can't walk on the grass and been instructed by that by an epithet, by signs posted everywhere, as if it's just saying, "Don't loiter." But there was racial slurs and epithets posted up as signs. And the men chafed under this. And eventually what happened is they took up arms against the townspeople. The African-American soldiers did, and they marched through the town and using the military discipline that they had learned, using the arms training that they had learned, and they shot innocent men, women, and children in the town. And there were courts-martials. Their leader committed suicide. There were courts-martial afterwards. It was a truly devastating event for African-Americans. And it did, of course, for the city of Houston, but what it did most profoundly is it proved right the what had been the pleading concerns of Southern politicians since the Revolutionary War. And that is, if you teach oppressed black men, although they didn't use these terms, but essentially if you teach these black men how to use arms, they are going to rise up against us and use those arms against us. And that was the argument used by General George Washington against arming African Americans, allowing them in the Continental Army. And after the mutiny in Houston, it was a damaging blow to the cause.
I mean, you're right. I mean, and it was even people like General Pershing and others who supported this policy. I mean, it's important, I think, what you note here, some of the great heroes of the American military, men like Pershing, men like George C. Marshall later in World War II, supported the segregation of the armed forces. I mean, these were men who supported the racist policies and are still at the same time contradictory in many ways, the heroes of American history.
That's right. General Pershing had no intention of allowing African-American troops under his command in Europe in World War One to fight. And the troops who wanted to fight were led by a young white colonel. They all wanted to fight, but the most mobilized one, who Colonel Franklin believed in the most, Colonel Hayward, he appealed directly to General Pershing and said, "My men have trained to fight. You know, there's a good unit, et cetera, et cetera." And General Pershing said, "Well, if you want to fight, you can go fight with the French because they need soldiers." And the African-American soldiers went with their colonel and joined, for all intents and purposes, they joined the French army during the war. The French called them les enfants perdus, the lost children, because it seemed that their own army had abandoned them. And
right.
The men learned French. The men learned how to use French weapons, and they were highly decorated. They're actually on the cover of the book. Some members of Les Enfants Perdus with the Croix de Guerre, a high medal, a high honor for their valor in battle during World War One.
Now, this is a story that when we come back from break, we'll talk about more, because I think that the story that you write, we have 2 minutes before we have to go to break here to talk about this wonderful radio station we're in. But the transition for the National Guard, the 15th in New York, and all the others that came through to kind of end up forming the 369th.
Yes.
And who they were, as opposed to the majority of African Americans who were in the armed forces, who were forced to do stevedore work and labor. These men fought with the French army. Great bravery, and how the American. We'll talk a bit, and we'll come back about how the American government tried very desperately to have the French treat them as the way the Americans would treat black folks. This is a really, I think a turning point in some ways in the consciousness of African Americans themselves because of the 369th. Do you think that's true?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. The Fighting 15th, as they called themselves, were a source of great pride. And what happened, as you said, with the memo that we could talk about after the break, when General Pershing appealed to the French army and said, "You should not even shake hands with these men," and the French disregarded the request and said, "These men are fighting with us." But they were astonished at how American troops so divided themselves, even when we're in the same uniform.
So we're going to take a very brief break and come right back. And when we come back, we're going to jump into World War One, what happened there, the lynchings afterwards, and during the course of the show, we're talking about the role that A. Philip Randolph and Roosevelt played and what Harry Truman did, which is truly amazing piece of the history I didn't know until I read this book. Stay with us. We'll be right back and continue our conversation with Ron James Jr., author of The Double V. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're talking with Ron James Jr. He's a D.C.-based author, a former Assistant Attorney General for the District of Columbia, author of the book Root and Branch, Charles Hamilton, Houston, Thurgood Marshall, and the Struggle to End Segregation. His newest book is Double V, How Wars, Protests, and Harry Truman Desegregated America's Military. And Ron, so going back to where we picked up, World War One. Let's take a couple of stories here. I think that are really emblematic. And it's the story of the 15th, as you write about, and how it became the 369th and the other regiments that joined in. People like Paul Robeson's brother were in that regiment, along with other incredible, well-known black intellectuals and artists who became part of that, and how they trained to go into combat. Tell that story.
Yes, they trained to go into combat. They were all grouped into 93rd Division. There were two divisions of African American soldiers. There was the 92nd Division and the 93rd Division. And these men trained for combat. And as we discussed earlier, several hundred of them were commissioned officers. But upon arriving to these shores in Europe, they swiftly learned that the army had little intention of allowing them to see combat. And so these soldiers began to fight for the right to fight, and not fight as in taking up arms against their superior officers, but they had to lobby their superior officers, including up to General Pershing, in order to get a chance to prove their mettle and also just to use the skills that they had learned. What the Army intended to do with the vast majority of African-American soldiers is to use them, as you said earlier, in the stevedore units. These were essentially labor battalions. And as the Washington Post even noted upon its report of being in Saint-Lazare, France, the port at Saint-Lazare is men unloading the ship arriving there. And the journalist wrote, "The spirit of Saint-Lazare is the spirit of the South." And he reported how they're just African-Americans. Many of the laborers, the African-American soldiers in these labor battalions, were not even issued uniforms. It was as if they were in the Army in name only. And part of, as I said earlier, the grand picture of what mobilized African-Americans, why this was such a changing experience for African-Americans nationwide, because whether one was a graduate of Amherst College, like Charles Hamilton Houston was, or whether he was a third-grade Mississippi sharecropper with a third-grade education, he was drafted into the same segregated army. And so there was no way that the what the members of what W.D. Du Bois called the talented tenth, there was no way they could exclude themselves from what was happening or say, well, our lives are a little bit better. We're pushing the race forward on our front because they were all in the same pot. And that is what mobilized the race, truly, and made the interwar period, the period between World War I and World War II, such a dynamic period in American life, but also in African-American life. Because my thesis of the book, I strongly believe, is that what we now call the Civil Rights Movement began with the struggle to desegregate America's military.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I thought about reading your book and talking about World War II especially, but both wars, is how I think that finally, the last several years, that black men, African American men who fought in World War II, were the spearhead to fight to end segregation.
Yes. I mean,
it was they're the ones who stood up and came back. Like both wars, we fought. We're here. We demand respect and we demand the end of segregation. That was the root of it all, really.
That is absolutely correct. And during World War II. When we get the double V's, African Americans said, well, during the first war, the famous quote was closed ranks. Essentially, African Americans stopped lobbying Congress for anti-lynching legislation, stopped protesting, said we are all in this fight together, we are Americans. Believing that when the war ended and black men had fought and America surely would be victorious, that their collective plight would improve. And after the war, the collective plight of African Americans went down the tubes. It became worse, which had not even seemed conceivable to black people living in 1910 America. That 1919,
yes,
after fighting in a victorious war, that their collective plight would be more violent, would be consist of more economic oppression.
I mean, when you write and we think about both the lynchings that took place and the Red Summer. What happened to World War I veterans coming back was just a crime against humanity in America.
It was astounding. It happened first with the grand parade that the Allied forces had. The United States was the only power that did not allow its black soldiers to march in the parade. All of the other Allied forces allowed their black soldiers to participate in the parade. And that was really the first sign of what was to come. Upon arriving back home, black soldiers heard and read from white politicians stating on the record that these black veterans would have to relearn the American way of life. And as one Mississippi senator said, we need to let them know that they are under surveillance. These white French women ruined soldiers. We need to let them know that they are under surveillance. And young groups of civilian white Southern men would attack the black veterans as they came off the trains wearing their uniforms. And this was part of, as you alluded to, the larger Red Summer of 1919, in which there were flat out, what can really only be described as small race wars in cities across the country. They were not riots with people throwing bottles. They were flat out wars happening. In Washington, D.C., you had African-American veterans of World War I taking up sniper positions on rooftops along U Street to fight back against encroaching white civilians and veterans who were coming to the black part of town to seek vengeance. It was incredible what happened during the summer of 1919 after America was victorious in a war.
And a few minutes we have here before break. I mean, I think that between the wars was kind of seminal time when they want to institute the draft, and how the NAACP and A. Philip Randolph and others said no to there should not be a draft. And you have this incredible quote in here from Princess Cooper that kind of blew me away in your book.
I'm not sure which quote you're...
Well, I'll tell you, here's the quote. Quote will take us a break and come back and pick up on it. Tennessee's governor, Prentice Cooper, told a group of African Americans, when they asked him to appoint black people to the state's draft board, he said, "This is white man's country. America was settled by English, Scot, and Irish settlers who came here and shed their blood for it. White men cut down the trees, plowed the fields, and developed America. the Negro had nothing to do with the settling of America. You fellows ought to be proud that you're in a great country like America. It's a blessed place for you and your people. Your preachers ought to tell your boys to go to the stations and register for military service, because if they don't, they'll be fined $10,000 or put in prison until they work it out.
Yeah. That's right. Just one of the amazing quotes I found in looking through. If you look in the references, I've just delved into the old African American newspapers. Think of the fantastic Baltimore Afro American. I mean, I think I cite that more.
Yes,
than
you
other,
do. You do. Yeah, you do a lot.
Other site. And that's where you find these amazing quotes that just shed light on the thinking at the time. And we're talking about the governor speaking on the record here. And this is what he's saying. You can imagine what the daily lot in life would be for these 19-year-old, many of them impoverished, many of them without a great deal of education, returning to the country, thinking that things would be better, and things had actually gotten worse.
We'll come back, and we'll take a break here in a minute. We'll come back and pick up here and go through World War II in our next segment. I keep looking at your picture, thinking about the men who fought in that regiments in World War I, who fought and saw heavy combat with the French, and these are the faces of men whose parents were probably slaves. That's just is mind-blowing. So we're going to come right back with Ron James Jr., his book, The Double V. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're talking with Ron James Jr. The book is The Double V, How Wars, Protests, and Harry Truman Desegregated America's Military. Ron James is a D.C.-based author. He's former Assistant Attorney General for the District of Columbia. His book before this was Root and Branch, Charles Hamilton Houston, Thurgood Marshall, and the Struggle to End Segregation. And, Ron, I'm glad you switched from law to writing. It's good for us, anyway.
Practice law. I'm actually a civilian trial attorney for the U.S. Navy, the Department of the Navy. But the views expressed in the book are entirely my own, I'm obligated to say.
So, yes, you are. I understand that. But and this interesting little side before we jump into World War II is that this is also family for you. Your father and your grandfather served.
Yes, it is. My father is a retired commander from the U.S. Navy. And both of his brothers are retired senior officers from the U.S. Army. And my grandfather, the book is dedicated to his memory. I was very close to him. And he served in a segregated Army unit during World War II.
Neither men talked much about their war experience, as most men don't, who went through these.
No, not at all. Not at all. And it's really incredible to learn about it. My grandfather was a military police officer in Alabama, and one of the first indications that the Army recognized that it had a problem, that segregation was posing a logistical problem, was when it realized that its white military police officers should not be policing its bases of black soldiers. And the War Department said, "We've got to find a way to fix this. We need to have black military police, MPs." And my grandfather was one of the first black MPs that the Army had. And the reason it is significant, as I said, is this was one of the very first indications that came from the War Department to demonstrate the fact that the people at the top, the generals and the civilian leadership, recognized that segregation was posing some logistical challenges to their warfighting efforts.
So let's talk about the period between the wars and get into World War II. So this was a very critical period when people were mobilizing to fight segregation. Roosevelt became president, and World War II is approaching. We all know about Tuskegee. Everybody's written about Tuskegee Airmen, and as they should. But very few people have written about other things you've written about. One of the things I think we've talked about in the show, but things like we'll come back in a minute. I want to get to the Golden 13 because I think that's an important story. But as this war was approaching, it was a role that people like A. Philip Randolph played. He played a role in this from after World War I all the way through the desegregation of the armed forces. His was a key role.
A. Philip Randolph deserves so much more credit than he widely receives in 2013. We just recently celebrated incredibly the birthday of Dr. King on the second inauguration of our first African-American president, and President Obama alluded to in his inauguration address to Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, the National Mall. The original, the first idea to march on Washington, that was A. Philip Randolph's idea more than two decades before 1963. It was when A. Philip Randolph told President Roosevelt, actually received an Oval Office meeting with the president. It was A. Philip Randolph and his advisors meeting with President Roosevelt and some of his advisors, telling him, we are going to march on Washington. And President Roosevelt asked Mr. Randolph how many marchers did he reasonably expect. And Philip Randolph told him that they had commitments from over 100,000 adults up and down the East Coast. President Roosevelt's own people verified this. Suddenly, and their goal was, they wanted two things. They wanted desegregation of the armed forces, and they wanted desegregation of the defense contractors. So it was President Eisenhower later called the military-industrial complex. But essentially, black people were being excluded from a big part of what was pulling America out of the Great Depression, and that was the defense contractors were revving up for war, and there was a great deal of work to be had, and African Americans were being excluded from it. President Roosevelt and his administration were terrified at the prospect of 100,000 angry Negroes marching down the National Mall and what that would look like to anyone sitting in Tokyo or Berlin. It would look like a nation divided once again. So he asked Randolph, Bill, I need you to call off this march of yours. And Randolph said, I can't do it without something from the White House. And that is when President Roosevelt, he did not desegregate the military. He refused to do that. What he did do was he issued an executive order desegregating the defense contracting industry. And this had a profound effect on the economic lives of African Americans living in cities across the country. And that's when A. Philip Randolph, only then did he did not call off the march. He agreed to, quote, postpone the Negro March on Washington.
And let's jump to, in the few minutes we have left, this really, we can't do your book with the justice without getting to the end of this book. The heartbeat here to me in many ways is the blinding of Isaac Woodard, the effect it had on Harry Truman, and the desegregation of our armed forces.
That's it, dude. I just get chilled every time I think
about the
episode of what happened to Isaac Woodard. Isaac Woodard had been discharged he's on his way to, the discharge process from the Army. He was on a bus, and he was riding home with some of his Army buddies who were white and black. And it was an integrated group riding through the rural South. And the fact that it was an integrated group bothered the civilian bus riders even before someone produced a bottle of whiskey and began to pass it around. Isaac Woodard was a known teetotaler. He did not drink at all. What he did do was when they came to a stop, he went to the bus driver and asked him how much further to a certain place. And the bus driver addressed him very rudely as a boy, and Woodard, standing there in his uniform, was simply refused to accept being spoken to like that. And he said, I'm a man, you speak to me like I'm a man. Well, in South Carolina at that time, that was enough to make someone appear as if he had been drinking a great deal. The bus driver drove a bit further, and came to a stop, and two police officers boarded the bus. They escorted Isaac Woodard off the bus, and they began to beat him. And they beat him so badly that they ruptured his eyeball. And then they sent him to jail. He awoke the next morning completely blind. When President Harry Truman heard this story relayed to him by the executive secretary of the NAACP, Walter Wright, he exclaimed in the Oval Office, I had no idea it was as bad as that. And that truly was a turning point in President Truman's mind, because President Truman, let's remember, had fought in war. He had been an officer. He had been an infantry officer, so he had faced war. And just as importantly, he knew how terrifying it can be for a soldier to return home, to economic uncertainty, to familial uncertainty. So he felt a kinship with these returning soldiers from World War II. And when he learned what was happening to African Americans, he became concerned and called this meeting. And when he heard what happened to Isaac Woodard, he vowed that he had to do something to stop it. And that, I believe, is when the turning point began for in the president's mind, that the way to stop it is we can integrate the military.
Ron James, Jr., the book is The Double V, How Wars, Protests, and Harry Truman Desegregated America's Military, an incredibly interesting book. Ron James, thank you for doing this. We're looking forward to your next work.
Thank you very much, and congratulations on 20 years.
Thank you very much, Ron. Take care.